La vida, esos que hacían que el resto de tu vida sintieses verdadera pasión por aquella asignatura. Así son nuestros profesores del Máster en Inglés Profesional. ¿Por qué no llamas? ¿Vas a perder esta oportunidad? 911-33-5833. 911-33-5833. Llama y solicita gratis tu prueba de nivel. 911-33-5833.
¿Te sientes orgulloso de ti mismo? Porque tú lo puedes hacer.
Con el Máster en Inglés Profesional puedes conseguir lo que quieras. Tú lo puedes hacer.
Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and on this program, I'm going to talk a little bit about what happened when sugar came to the British Empire, specifically sugar coming to Barbados, the island in the Lesser Antilles, and later on to Jamaica. Now, on earlier programs, I talked about the background, right, los antecedentes, the background to this, how Brazil had been important in sugar growing, how Portugal had practically monopolized the sugar industry at one point, but how, because of the union of the crowns, because the Spanish and the Dutch were enemies, how the Dutch had taken over. And little by little, the Dutch were driven out of Brazil. The Dutch left Brazil, but they left with a clear understanding of sugar production and the technology. Many of the Dutch went to that no man's land between Venezuela and Brazil, Guyana, and there were also Dutch who relocated in other parts of the Caribbean, in the Antilles. And that brings us to Barbados. Barbados was completely unlike what had happened in Brazil. In Brazil, Engenho, there was a big house, there was a big church, there were all kinds of areas to make it self-sufficient, right? The area was entirely undercapitalized. And so in Brazil, everybody had to think about subsistence. They had to think about autarky. Everything that the plantation needed had to be made on the plantation. That includes the food, the clothes, and to a large extent, the equipment. Whereas little by little in Barbados, because it was so lucrative to grow sugar, and nothing like this has ever happened in human history, ever. The growth of sugar is entirely unprecedented. Between the year, 1630 and the year 1800, people were consuming something like 100 times the amount of sugar that they had eaten before. And of course, this had all sorts of effects on diet, on teeth. As I mentioned on an earlier program, it meant the collapse of spices. People were no longer so interested in putting spices onto their food, but it also meant the availability of cheap calories, so that Europeans had cheap calories. All of a sudden, they had a source of energy, a plentiful source of energy. To get the same amount of calories that, say, the English labor force was using at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, you would have needed vast extensions of land dedicated to potato farming or wheat farming. But with sugar, all of this could come from plantations on the other side of the world, and it could come very, very cheaply. And as I say, no other place in the world had that kind of advantage. Asia did not have that kind of advantage. By the way, if you talk about the food in Asia, Asian culinary traditions, Asian cuisine, you don't find sugar. It isn't traditional. There can be sugary things. Sugary things included, because of the 20th century, sugary things may be included in some of the dishes invented by the different European colonial empires. But native, indigenous sweets, you don't find that, not at all. So, as I say, Brazil and now the Caribbean begin to eclipse Asia in terms of value to the West. And sugar more than equals the amount of the value of what Spain is extracting from mines in the America, the silver and gold. The ingenios were working night and day, the sugar mills. And there were sugar refineries in the New World as well. I mean, in 1615, there were five in London. But by 1670, there were 30. And by the year 1700, there were 75. And those numbers just kept growing exponentially. The same in Amberes, Antwerp. They say that the skies were black from the smoke of the sugar refineries in Antwerp. And at about this same time, the income, the amount of money earned per year by a Jamaican planter, a plantation owner, would be something like 2,200 pounds per year on average. Now, in the 13 colonies, the future United States, in North America, the average person might earn 60 pounds per year. So yes, you can imagine the difference. The rest of the empire was pretty much put into service for Barbados and Jamaica and the other sugar-producing areas. So 80% of the ships coming from Boston, not so much from England. The overwhelming majority of the ships in Boston Harbor involved in the West India trade. And a part of this in textiles. Now, the British especially, they began to specialize in textiles, first to trade for slaves in Africa, and then for special clothing made specifically for slaves. Slave clothing was completely different from the clothing that Europeans wore. Obviously, it was cheaper and stronger. This helped stimulate the textile industry. Remember that the textile industry was going to be the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in England, and these ready-made markets, they were a very important part of that. That allowed England to overcome its dependence on wool, lana, right? Unfortunately, a little like Castile, and even Aragon, with La Mesta, right? The wool production, the transhumancia and all of that, there was no real value added in that. All of the wool was shipped as raw material to Northern Europe, or in the case of Aragon, to Italy. And all of the value added happened there. The transformation into textiles happened there. If you are only producing raw material, you are completely dependent on prices, international competition, and so that for the longest time, Castile and England were both trying to sell their wool at the cheapest price. Now, all of a sudden, because of these colonial requirements, well, England gets a chance to get out of that cycle. And then you had people making lots and lots of money. These people who became very rich very quickly in the West India trade with sugar plantations, they began to oppose the royal monopolies, and they began to form a very powerful lobby in Parliament with the need to express themselves in a free press. In other words, the merchants feeling the need to protect themselves against arbitrary royal power. In other words, the slavery in the Caribbean, part of this, the beginnings of constitutional monarchy and certainly of capitalism. Now, in the year 1944, there was an economist named Eric Williams. He was black. He was from the Caribbean, from the West Indies. And all the way back in 1944, he had this idea that capitalism, as we know it, was created through this system, through the plantation system, through slavery. And at the time, people didn't take him seriously, but over the years, this has begun to work toward a consensus. Many of the objections initially was that, for example, there were other things that produced a greater amount of profit than slave plantations. And yet, slavery was the reason for the viability of the New World. You know, other than the extraction of gold and silver from mines in the Americas, there really was no value to the New World. If you think of a parallel universe without without sugar, without slaves, you don't have a New World. You don't have transcontinental traffic. You don't really have a European presence. So the old saying that without Angola, no slaves. Without slaves, no sugar. Without sugar, no Brazil. At least this is what they used to say in Portugal, but it could easily go for the British Empire as well. The time we're talking about, the middle of the 17th century, the value of sugar on the world market exceeded the value of all other tropical commodities, including spice, all of it combined. Now, as I mentioned earlier, at this time, the end of the 30 Years' War, the creation of the nation state, you were going to have no more crusades, no more religious wars. The idea that Catholics and Protestants will always be implacable enemies is subordinate to a new idea that individual states do not have enemies and allies, they simply have interests. And the world was not going to be the same again. 1648 meant the end of the 30 Years' War, and, 3 years later, 1651, was the end of the English Civil War. The Commonwealth could not outlast Cromwell. When Cromwell died, they tried to put his son on the throne, not the throne, but they tried to put his son in charge, and the result was esperpentico. Now, in part, I've been talking about this, you know, for a while. I've been talking about this on other programs, but because the Dutch were so very thorough in Asia, right, thorough, minucioso, the Dutch were so thorough in Asia, resorting to genocide and all sorts of unscrupulous practices to acquire a monopoly on spices and convert Amsterdam into the greatest spice market in the world. prices went up, and the Dutch began to matar la gallina de los huevos de oro, right? They began to kill the goose that laid the golden egg. It is certainly no coincidence at this time that France, under Louis XIV, decides that it's had enough of spice, that spice is not cool anymore. Louis and his cuisinier, La Varenne, he comes up with something new, delicate and insulso, right, and bland. So the elite, naturally, they follow the king in everything. And so if Louis XIV decides that spices are out, then the market just dries up. And yes, you will still find spices in, I don't know, croquetas or pâté or certain things. And especially, well, a lot more spice in Amsterdam than anywhere else in Europe. But that, I mean, just the power of French style. And as I say, the English king, Charles II, he had been raised in France. He had been raised under the tutelage of the French king. He knew Versailles. This is going to be equally true of the Bourbon kings in Spain, so that you have the grandson of Louis XIV, Felipe V, coming to Spain and sort of recreating this French style in Spain as well. And this can be true in the future. I mean, even in times of Louis XIV, there was an official style in terms of decorative arts, and there was this personal style, right? His decorator, Le Brun, was responsible for both. And the official style was very showy, very ostentatious, right? Baroque, almost Rococo, whereas the personal style for Louis XIV was actually much more austere. It was the beginning of what is later going to be called neoclassical, all filled with straight lines, not curves. And so you have the future of art for, what, the next 100 years there in the court of Versailles. And so why not the future of cuisine for the next 500 years, who knows? Also there in Versailles, they decide that spices are out. They decide that delicate flavors are in. And they take all of this sugar that's coming in. They make it decorative so that in a banquet you might have a centerpiece made entirely out of enormous sculptures of sugar. But yes, a lot of that sugar relegated to dessert. Europeans are the inventors of sugar-based desserts. Previously, sugar was in everything. Previously, a chicken pie might have the same amount of sugar that we associate with an apple pie today. So yes, you're still going to get spices. You'll get spices in sauces or in ragu or soup, maybe, but not universally, and not as common. Of course, the big unknown, the big empty spot in world cuisine is precisely Spain. People do not know Spanish cuisine or understand it outside of Spain, so that when you talk about, you know, you talk to somebody who knows a lot about international cuisine, and you say paprika, right, pimentón, and the person will say, oh yeah, paprika, Hungary. We know that Hungarian food, Hungarian goulash, has a lot of paprika in it. But the fact is that Spanish food uses a lot more paprika than Hungarian food does, and nobody understands that. Nobody knows that. Now, even in Spain, people don't appreciate this. Or you talk to people outside of Spain. You say garlic, ajo, and everybody says, "Oh yeah, garlic," because it has a bad reputation. Garlic, food from Sicily. Everybody understands that Sicilian food uses a lot of garlic, but the fact is that generally Spanish cooking uses a lot more garlic than Southern Italian cuisine or Greek cuisine. And nobody knows this, nobody appreciates it, and not in Spain, not out of Spain. So, as I say, Spanish cuisine, sort of invisible in the general world, in spite of the fact that you have star chefs from Spain, in spite of the fact that you have Spanish restaurants in many different cities around the world. What you normally get is a tourist coming to, I don't know, to Galicia or to crossing the Pyrenees, right, to Aragon or to the Canary Islands. And the first thing they want is sangria and paella. And at least to me, that suggests a chronic inability of Spain to sell itself, right? To live up to its potential, to take the profile that it should have in the world. And I can understand how in the 20th century that was very difficult. But I believe there is no excuse. There is no excuse to maintain this situation in the 21st century. But getting back to the 17th century, what I was talking about, the population grew. The population grew in the 17th century in a big way. But the demand for spices decreased, and the consumption of spices decreased in Europe radically during that time. Perhaps you can blame this on the Dutch. As I say, once they had this monopoly, they raised the prices, and maybe they killed the goose that laid the golden egg. Or it might be a question of state, right? France had no interest in paying those prices, and so they developed their own style of cuisine, very influential. Or, and I've read this theory as well, that sugar, this exponential increase in the consumption of sugar just eliminated spices from the European diet. And things did not go well for the Dutch East India Company. They began to lose money because they were so deeply involved in the government as well. They were supported in a big way, subvencionados, right? Subsidized, but still, sometimes they had to give out dividends in the form of spices. At one point, they burned 2 million pounds of nutmeg and mace, mathis, no? Of nutmeg and mace, just because they could, right? They had an excess of supply. If they wanted to get rid of it, they would have to lower the price. And rather than do that, they simply burnt, what, a million kilograms of the stuff. As the company went bankrupt, sort of like a zombie, it was too big to fail, right? It began to borrow money. Remember that individuals in the company really had no loyalty to the company, and so it belonging to the company did not pay very well. This was an incentive for people at every level to accept bribes, right, sobornos, or to look the other way when things were being smuggled, right, smuggled, contrabandear, traficar. So that it was just a question of time before the French began to take nutmeg and cloves and plant them on their own territories off the coast of Africa in Mauritius and Reunion. This was, about by the year, just before Napoleon, the Dutch East India Company was liquidated, and there still was a presence there. I mean, Indonesia was Dutch. The Japanese took it over from the Dutch. There were other things to be had there. I mean, once in the 19th century, once rubber could be vulcanized, all of a sudden, plantations all over the world, latex plantations, caoutchouc, rubber became a very, very big thing in Indonesia and Malaysia. But the Japanese took over. The Batavia did not become Jakarta again until 1950. Okay, but I'm going to have to take a break. I'll be back in just a minute.
Bit for Teens.
¿Y de qué se trata eso?
Es un programa intensivo de inglés que dura una semana aquí en Madrid en un colegio mayor y son clases y actividades muy chulas. Año tras año. Hay niños que repiten, chicos, chavales, vienen cansados, agotados. Ahora que notan el empujón que se le da al inglés, de verdad. Y lo más importante es que vienen con ganas de seguir aprendiendo, motivados, y eso es lo más importante.
Una pregunta que se hará la gente que nos está escuchando, por ejemplo, que nos está escuchando fuera de Madrid.
Uh-huh.
¿Algún día se hará esto de los VIP en otras zonas?
¿En otras zonas de España?
Lo dejamos ahí, que puede ser.
Sí.
Todo llega,
todo llegará. Viene gente de toda España, ¿eh? Vienen participantes
sí, también
de
es
toda
verdad,
España.
Verdad. Pero bueno, hay gente que no quiere moverse mucho de su zona.
Sí.
Y bueno, teniendo más oportunidades de hacerlo
más cerca
bueno, de su
delegación. Desplazarse, sí.
¿Hay un sitio donde pueden informarse? ¿Una web?
Pues lo mejor es llamarnos.
Lo
mejor es llamarnos.
No pueden llamar para tratar lo que queráis. Sobre todo si preguntáis por los campamentos, que es el 911335832.
Sí.
Ahora dilo tú.
91, lo mejor es llamarnos, ¿o qué? Un número. A ver, 911335832. Y ahí ya les damos información de primera mano.
Nos quedan poquitas plazas, ¿eh? Siempre lo decimos, no es mentira, es que como lo vamos dejando todo para el último momento, pues luego pasa lo que pasa. Podéis llamarnos al 911335832 y ahí nuestros maravillosos compañeros van a informarte de todo lo relacionado con los campamentos. Nunca me cansaré de decir el teléfono. ¿Queréis decirlo vosotros? La última oportunidad.
Vale, 913-35832.
Hasta luego.
Si te acabas de licenciar, no entres en el mercado laboral ni te plantees un máster hasta no resolver del todo la cuestión del inglés. Resuelve el tema ahora, mientras eres joven y tienes tiempo. Después, es casi imposible. Y recuerda, para los reclutadores vale más un probado dominio del inglés que una docena de másters.
Resuélvelo ya. Llámanos. 911335833. 911335833. Recuerda hacer tu prueba de nivel sin compromiso. Llámanos. 911335833. Y ahora financiate el 100% del máster. Consulta condiciones en grupobaugan.com.
Aquí llega Lorena Martínez con la última pregunta del examen. Vaya, parece que le ha caído el pass perfect. Lorena lleva toda la temporada entrenando el pass perfect, pero nunca ha sido su punto fuerte. ¡Wow! Eso es Lorena. Vamos, vamos. Fill the gap, Lorena. ¡Wow! Increíble. Has acertado todas. ¡Qué barbaridad! Lorena Martínez, señoras y señores, qué crack. El examen es de 10.
Consigue que tus hijos sean unos auténticos cracks del inglés con los cursos del Club Junior. No solo mejorarán sus notas, sino que hablarán inglés de verdad y serán capaces de comunicarse. Y por si eso fuera poco, lo pasan genial en clase. Club Junior son las clases para niños de 4 a 17 años en grupos muy reducidos y 100% método Vaughan. Infórmate ya en el 911335832, 911335832 o en grupovaughan.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and on the first part of the program, I was talking about spices and sugar, and especially the power of sugar, and how it was possible that a sugar, more than anything, and the slave plantations, right, the ingenious in Brazil, and how that knowledge spread, especially to Barbados, which became one of the great drivers of the British economy in the 17th century, how that is largely responsible for the creation of modern capitalism. It all comes down to control. Now, the origin of the word control, control, actually, you have el rollo, right? The roll, rotulus, and you have to check it against something. So that would be the contra rotulus, right? En contra del el rollo, the counter roll. So from that counter roll, we get the word control. Numerification, quantification, verification. And in this case, the creation of what in English was often called book farming. Book farming was considered a kind of an insult, right? A real farmer isn't a book farmer. Book farmers were the kinds of people who took innovation seriously. It involved reading the latest, because at this time there was an explosion of literature on the subject of how-to books. So reading everything and putting ideas into practice. And this involved careful record-keeping and numerical analysis with the idea that this would lead to increased output, and increased output leading to profits, higher profits. And all of this considered a part of economic freedom. Remember that economic freedom, free trade, free markets. Economic freedom doesn't mean that the people are free. It doesn't mean that the people who contribute to this system are free. In this case, it works a lot better if you have an enslaved workforce. That means that the labor costs can be factored in as assets, not as costs, and that you have very tight control over human capital, right? Because all of this is about the allocation of resources. In the 20th century, in the mid 20th century, you had the Vienna School of economists talking about how free markets inevitably lead to the freedom of the individual, the individual's choice, that you cannot have a truly free person without a free market. in this case, decisions made by commissars in a controlled market economy that would inevitably lead to distortions, that would lead to diseconomies and to coercion or exploitation. Where you have free markets, you generally have freedom of choice and individuals who are free to plan their destinies in, you know, to the best of their abilities. However, if you go back a couple of centuries, you do have free trade, but it certainly doesn't mean that the people involved are free. No. In the beginning, these people were enslaved. Now, traditionally, when all of this is taught, when management is taught in business schools, they talk about a later stage. So, for example, the New York and Erie Railroad. You had a canal that revolutionized New York and connected the Great Lakes to New York Harbor. That meant a real difference for New York. This was in the age of canals. Now, the age of canals was quickly superseded by the age of railroads. And one of these first railroads, New York and Erie Railroad, with an organizational chart on where and when to allocate resources and an intense concentration on complex operations. And as I say, this is the way it's normally taught in business school, but it's wrong because for 100 years before that, or at least more than 100 years, you had accounting books from plantations that could be compared, studied, so that any breakdown, right, avería, or any bottleneck, como cuello de botella, digamos un atasco, any bottleneck at any stage of production would mean that the whole thing has to stop. On an earlier program, I was talking about how time-sensitive sugar production is. And as I say, these are not taken into account. The standard histories of the way all of this starts begins with the railroads, right? You have Taylorism. You have Frederick Winslow Taylor and talking about his time and motion studies and the replaceable parts and so forth. But at least in the United States at that time, there were 4 million slaves, and many of these plantations were much bigger and much more complicated than what the railroads were trying to do. Meanwhile, they will tell you that one of the very first keys to capitalism is the idea of a separation between ownership and management. And this was a big part of the plantation economy, starting in Barbados, but then also going to Jamaica, so that the owners, after making it big, they would go back, they would build palaces, they would build some of the most splendid architecture in Europe comes from sugar plantations. Think of the 19th century. Think of Barcelona and how Barcelona lived from Cuba. So that, you know, the Marqués de Comillas, for example, is a patron. The Sagrada Familia probably would not exist if it weren't for the slave plantations, right? Being the subject of meticulous records and un desglose, a breakdown of arrobas por negro, all of the attempts in the 19th century, you know, to be like the neighbors and to get rid of slavery were strongly resisted by the Catalan lobby. So that when Manuel Becerra and Segismundo Moret proposing a law for greater independence and for manumission and so forth, Canovas de Castillo would not hear that because he was afraid of how the Catalans would react. So yes, in many of these cases, you had absentee landlords and these people living very well in England, in Scotland, and the supervisors, again, no need for a big house, no need for a church, no, on the island itself, everything is business. So yeah, you get a typical page out of one of these account books. You've got 336 field men, 405 field women, right? Initially in the slave trade, you did not want that many women. However, there were certain cultures that only settled women, right? There were times when there would only be women on the market, or the ratio of women to men, like 2-to-1, so that little by little, the women were given harder tasks to do. And later on, they were working as hard as the men, doing more or less the same job. So yeah, you've got 336 field men, 405 field women, 34 drivers, right, negreros, who in this case were also enslaved, 100 watchmen, 52 house slaves, and 222 children, children being put to work in different groups according to their ages, and with different specializations in many cases. The wain man, wain is the old word for wagon, and so wagon was reduced to wain, el carro, or un cartero. Cartero, right, the man who rides the wagon, being the wainman, one of the old words for one of the old sustantivos derivado de work is right, RWRIGHT, right, and that of course is a last name, right, is a very common surname. So a worker, someone who does something, would be a right. And it's also a surname in combination. And many of these surnames come from professions. So you get a boat right, un barquero, or you get a wain right, un cartero, or a smith, herrero, a sawyer from working the saw, o sierra. In addition to which, on this particular plantation, I'm talking about a plantation in Jamaica, a sugar plantation, there was a distiller, so that this plantation produced rum as well. In addition to which, there were two doctors, and the doctors were slaves. There were two midwives. Now, Spanish distinguishes between a comadrona and a partera, right? The comadrona has studies, but the partera does not. One supposes that a comadrona has a lot more experience and theoretical knowledge than a partera. In English, this is simply a midwife. The word wife in Old English simply meant woman. Just like in German today, Weib means woman. And mit, if again, like in German, it means with. So that with and mit are actually very, very similar. So the midwife is the person with the woman when she's giving birth. And as I say, on this plantation, there was two dedicated midwives and a rat catcher. And all of these people listed in columns with their ages and how much they are currently worth, plus a list of the children, potential children to replace them in these professions. So if you have these assets, you don't have to worry about turnover, right? The replacing workers who leave, right? You have to recruit, you have to negotiate, you have to incentivize, right? All of these things are missing when the labor is enslaved. I was talking about a company, a multinational in Spain, where I was teaching. And it was a multinational, and they were comparing the Spanish company with the Dutch company in Holland. They had a 40% turnover per year, meaning that 40% of the workers would disappear, would find another job. And this made things impossible, right? Long-term planning, all of these things, very, very difficult. And they looked to Spain, and turnover in Spain was practically zero, right? Almost nobody left the job. And so the entire corporation was looking to Spain as a sort of model for how to retain workers. Now, of course, in the real world, you would have to compare the labor market in the Netherlands, how many other jobs are available and whether they are better jobs. You know, there might be jobs that attract people, whereas you would not find that in Spain. In Spain, generally, people who have jobs feel themselves lucky to have that job. Everybody is very aware of the tragedy of unemployment. But that wasn't part of the narrative. The narrative was that turnover was 40% in the Netherlands and almost 0%, something like 3% in Spain. And Spain could take the credit for that, that they were able to achieve this degree of loyalty on the part of their employees. However, going back, as I say, to the early days of capitalism, when you did have labor, say, in places like New England, quite often the turnover was 100%. You could never count on somebody staying at the same job for an entire year, much less the training of their children to replace them. You wouldn't be able to think of human capital and the skill base the way that the sugar plantations routinely did. So that when you compare these accounting books on plantations to accounting books in the North, in the early factories there, the report books in the North are filled with blanks, right? Huecos, because you never know. You can't count on these people being there. And, a lot of it in the North, there was always a lack of cash. Remember, for solid money, in the Northern colonies, the future United States, and then, of course, the United States, a lot of that, the real money going around was Spanish silver, because in the lack of a central bank, and in many cases, during the Revolutionary War, the fact that the government had issued pagarés, right, and that towns and everybody, it was working on this fictitious money, right? Simple paper with no intrinsic value, almost like a cryptocurrency. Quite often, the worker preferred to have food or alcohol or cloth or something like that in exchange for the labor. So, although in the record book, it's always entered as cash, in practice, at least initially, quite often, workers were not paid in cash. And again, people were fully prepared to see the slave system be adapted to factories. This was done in a limited way in places like Virginia. But again, a little like the Roman Empire. In the Roman Empire, you had a slave economy, and the Romans had the technology for inventions that save labor, right? The Romans had la noria, but they really never adapted it for irrigation. When the British took over Rio Tinto, the mines in Rio Tinto, that had been worked by the Romans, they discovered that there were many nodias, right? There were many water wheels there para achicar a las minas, right? To bail out or to drain the mines of water. But the Romans didn't use this technology widely because they had slaves. The same thing with mills, windmills and water mills. The Romans had that technology, but no incentive to use it in a slave economy. You see the use of windmills and water mills in the Roman Empire toward the end of the empire, when they were having real problems procuring slaves. So, as I say, none of this applies to the traditional, and very, very profitable management of a sugar plantation. There were records for everything. The slaves kept sticks in order to manage themselves, sticks with the indicating the tools that they had borrowed, sticks indicating how much they had worked, and so they kept these sticks. The sticks, again, checked against the book entries in order to minimize hurto, theft, or vandalism, or simply to keep control of the way things were going. In addition to which, older people and ill people were generally used as supervisors. This is not just the efficient use of capital. It is the idea that, you know, perhaps the old who had been accustomed to living like this for so long, or the ill who were dependent on medical treatment, would have a greater degree of loyalty to the system, first. Secondly, the old and the ill have a very limited chance of escaping. On the plantation I'm talking about, you also have 15 runaways. Now, runaways can be serious business. They can be used as collateral. I mean, slaves are collateral, right? They are assets. And so if you want to procure a credit, you can use your slaves in that way. If a slave runs away, then the bank is going to ask for something else. In many cases, the slaves would have written permission, which meant that it was going to be impossible to teach them how to read or write. Otherwise, the temptation, the risk would be too great. In places like Barbados, later on, this would be punishable by death, theoretically, right? Capital punishment, teaching a slave how to read. Or if the slave had discovered by himself how to read, he would be executed. If a slave escapes, the failure to recapture him means a huge fine. You have to take these things seriously. And of course, there were professional slave catchers. Now, there were enormous communities of escaped slaves out in the hills. But in Jamaica, at least, they signed a deal with the British government that they would be responsible for returning any escaped slaves. In other words, the British government said that they would be left in peace in the interior of the island, but that in the future, any escaped slaves would be returned and any slave rebellions would be repressed. So that in Jamaica, for example, in the 1770s, there was a major rebellion, and the government and the Maroon community, right, Los Cimarrones, they worked together to repress this rebellion. Little by little, the proportion of slave to free became alarming. So 80% by the late 18th century, 18th century, by 1780, 90% in the British Caribbean and in what would be Haiti. I mean, Haiti was just waiting to happen. It was entirely foreseeable. Yeah, as I say, getting back to what I was originally talking about, the sugar plantation as the beginnings of what we now know as modern business management, as capitalism, right? The distance between ownership and management, and the division between management and sales, because many times you had specialized people in charge of dealing with customers and shipment. Now, this would be completely removed from administration and supervision, and responsible to absentee landlords. By 1825, more than three quarters of the landlords in Jamaica, of the plantation owners, were absentees. And when the whole thing is reduced to numbers on a page, that makes decision-making relatively easy, right? There's a certain anonymity. It's quantitative, right? The workers and the output only as numbers. This creates, in theory at least, a lack of control. However, accounting practices were created in order to overcome this difficulty, with differing strategies in order to maximize profits. But I seem to run out of time. Thank you for listening, and please listen to my next program.
Tengo 23 años y acabo de terminar la carrera de Administración y Dirección de Empresas. Decidí hacer este máster antes de acabar la carrera porque mi nivel de inglés era realmente bajo. Veía que tenía que buscar un trabajo y que necesitaba un buen nivel de inglés. Y creí que esta era la mejor forma y una alternativa a irte fuera. Así que decidí compaginar un poco los estudios con el inglés. Y ahora que he terminado, hace una semana que he terminado los estudios, si tengo que buscar trabajo, me siento un poco más preparada. Lo mejor es el equipo de profesores que tienen. Hacen las clases muy amenas y aprovechamos el tiempo al máximo.
No importa lo que hayas estudiado, no importa a qué te quieras dedicar, hagas lo que hagas, vas a necesitar el inglés. Haz un máster que realmente merezca la pena. Haz el máster en inglés profesional de Vaughan.